Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
Why War Again? Lilia Shevtsova. The Russian aggression against Ukraine has kicked over the geopolitical chessboard. Neither the global system of governance nor the Western states have been prepared for the new trauma. The 21st century has returned violence, brutal force, and destruction to the European agenda. War is usually seen as an instrument for solving interstate problems. Today, war is viewed by some illiberal states as the means by which they can salvage their obsolete systems through containment of the West. The world is returning to a civilizational clash between traditionalism and modernity. This is exactly what Putin's Russia does, using aggression to save a personality-based system of rule. China is watching in the wings. War and militarism as a way of life. Today's Russia has discarded hopeful assumptions about its integration into Europe, preferring to remind the world of its uniqueness. Russian civilization has demonstrated an amazing ability to concentrate all its national resources, to an extent unparalleled in any other nation, to wage war as the means of sustaining one-man rule. War reverberated throughout Russian Tsarist and Soviet history. Russia has always been a militarized state, and militarism has been the lifeblood of its social and political organization. In fact, Russia's history unfolded in cycles, from war to peace, the latter was merely a pause and the stage of preparation for the new war, and then back to war again. The Russian system has evolved as a form of both defense from military aggression, real or imagined, and the instrument for military expansion. Moreover, Russia has used war as a way to re-energize itself. Peter the Great and Stalin's militarization campaigns turned the whole nation into a military regiment, and subsequently, Russia was unable to find a way out of the war paradigm. Its rulers were unable, and remain unable, to run the country in times of peace. Russia failed to use the 1917 fall of Tsarism or the 1991 Soviet collapse to escape from the military mode of survival. During the Yeltsin period and the early Putin presidencies, one got the impression that the Russian elite would adapt to a peaceful way of life. For part of his reign, Putin maintained a hybrid regime and cooperated with the West. But the vector of his rule was clear already, strengthening state control over all facets of life. Ukraine's 2004 Orange Revolution became a turning point for the Russian regime, marking the start of the Kremlin's anti-Orange strategy. By the end of 2013, before its war with Ukraine, the Kremlin had already stopped pretending and adopted the new Putin doctrine, legitimating tougher rule and a more assertive stance toward the world, pushing Russia back towards the militarist paradigm. What has forced the Kremlin to return to the besieged fortress model? I would mention several circumstances: shrinking internal financial and economic resources, the rise of protest activity in 2011 to 2012, and the fear that even mild political struggle could threaten Putin's regime. Putin's rejection of modernization that could ruin the status quo, the Kremlin's decision to prepare the coercion machine before new turmoil surfaced, the attempt to channel growing social dissatisfaction away from the Kremlin and towards new enemies. By the beginning of 2014, the Kremlin had presented its new political outlook, based on the assumption that the world is in crisis and the West no longer dominates the global economy and international politics, all signs of the West's terminal decline. By declaring the end of liberal democracies, Vladimir Putin closed the pro-Western period of Russian history that had begun in 1991. Here are the main premises of the Putin doctrine that has become the ideological framework for his new political regime. First, Russia is a special state civilization based on a return to traditional values and sealed by traditional religion. Second, Russia is becoming the chief defender of Christianity and faith in God. Third, Russia is going to unify the post-Soviet space and become an independent center of global development. The Kremlin's struggle for Ukraine fully demonstrates its seriousness in pursuit of this goal. In short, we are talking about the return to an archaic fundamentalist autocracy which clearly sets itself against the liberal democracies. The former Soviet Union was keen on spreading communist ideology around the world. The Kremlin, however, intends to do more. It will try to offer the world its vision of moral values and defend it from the decaying influence of liberal democracy. The Kremlin has stopped pretending and has openly declared this new agenda, to turn Russia into the anti-West. However, as suggested by the Kremlin's past attempts to solve its problems through military patriotic mobilization, the Second Chechen War of 1999, and the 2008 Russia-Georgia War, this type of mobilization soon turns out to be short-lived and requires constant validation, with additional triumphs over the enemy, real or imagined. It also requires limited casualties, since the loss of lives can undermine the leader's support base. The paradox is that in a country where the population is easily drugged by militarist propaganda, people are afraid of bloodshed and hate the thought of war. Previous instances of Russian citizens' consolidation around their leader, in the wake of military threats during the Yeltsin and Putin presidencies, were over in a matter of months. The Crimean consolidation is going to last longer. The Crimea-induced hangover will eventually end. Then the Kremlin will have to distract Russians from their worries and frustration with the regime once again. But the Kremlin has fewer distraction strategies up its sleeve, especially given that it has played its trump card, war, and the threat of war. Russia's war with Ukraine. The reason why Ukraine plays such an important role in the self-reproduction of the Russian system is because including Ukraine in Russia's orbit helps Russia to maintain its European face. Besides, the Russian political class still considers Ukraine, with Kiev as its capital, to be part of the Russian community, Russia's younger brother. In the eyes of many Russians, Kiev and Kievan Rus are cradles of Russian orthodoxy and indispensable parts of its origin story. To many, Kiev is as important to Russia as Kosovo and the 14th century battle for Kosovo are to the Serbs. What will become of Putin's Eurasian Union without Ukraine? With the younger brother absent, it would clearly be a defective family. As the Kremlin adopted a new survival strategy through containment of the West, Ukraine became the red line against liberal democracy. The Kremlin's war in Ukraine has acquired an unusual dimension. During the period of open warfare from 2014 to 2015, Russia and Ukraine maintained diplomatic relations. And this was not just an exercise in soft power or information warfare, but in hard power as well. In September 2014, the warring sides, the Ukrainian government and the pro-Russian separatists, heavily aided by regular Russian forces, declared a ceasefire. However, shelling from both sides continued, and there was evidence that the pro-Russian separatists continued their offensive, trying to expand the territory under their control. In February 2015, Chancellor Merkel and President Hollande brokered a new peace agreement, Minsk II, that also began to unravel. Bitter irony is that Berlin and Paris have been justifying this paradoxical situation when the country aggressor at the same time has been playing the role of mediator. It is a deadlock situation that proves that at the moment there is no peaceful exit from the war unless the Kremlin rejects its traditional patter of survival. No truce can hold while both sides view the ceasefire as a temporary pause and their peace agendas remain incompatible. While the Kremlin refuses to recognize that Russia is at war with Ukraine, it won't normalize relations with Kiev either. And Ukraine is not an end in itself for Putin's Russia, but merely an instrument for the Kremlin's wider ambitions. By destabilizing Ukraine, Russia is fighting a proxy war with the West. Putin has been perfectly candid about his reasons for wanting to do this, stating time and again that Russia is a unique civilization which seeks to contain the West, not only inside Russia, but outside it too. Moscow has been attempting to wear the peacemaker's hat without ever doffing its battle helmet. It may indeed succeed in this attempt, given that the lines between war and peace remain fuzzy, and given that the Europeans are ready to involve the Kremlin in the negotiating process at any cost. Moscow's goal is to force Kiev to agree to the special status of the occupied part of the Donbas region, thus lodging a permanent thorn in Ukraine's side. For the time being, Ukraine has lost its war with Russia and will always face the threat of Russia's bullying until Russia changes its paradigm of militarist survival. But Ukrainians have a chance to consolidate their pro-European platform and start building a new system on the territory they have. In order to make their project successful, they need willpower from their elites and assistance from the West. The war in Ukraine that Putin's Kremlin is waging with the West will have unpredictable geopolitical consequences. One of them is clear today. Nuclear security and non-proliferation policies have been undermined, and European security is threatened by the US and Russia abandoning the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. The aggression against Ukraine, which relinquished all of its nuclear weapons in exchange for guarantees of its territorial integrity, may unleash a new global nuclear arms race. The violation of internationally recognized borders may foster other global actors' aggressive designs, in particular China, which demonstrates a propensity for solving its border disputes by force. The Kremlin challenged the West to draw a red line in response to its revanchist ambitions, and so far, the West has failed to rise to the challenge. The West confused. Ukraine is a victim of both the Russian system's struggle for survival and the West's inability to protect the international legal space. For the West, ending this confrontation may prove to be even more agonizing than ending the Cold War, for the following reasons. 1. The West is refusing to recognize that this is not a regional crisis, but a clash of opposing systems. 2. The West has lost the ability to contain a civilizational adversary. 3. The Kremlin has created self-protection mechanisms within Western societies. 4. The liberal democracies still don't see the need to fight for norms in their foreign policies. 5. The system of global governance, which was based on the outcome of the Second World War, no longer fits today's world. 6. Russia's aggression against Ukraine has blossomed into a crisis of Ukrainian statehood. There is a set of beliefs that contributed to the emergence of this confrontation and complicated its resolution. One of the popular myths about the standoff between Russia and the West in Ukraine is that of Russia's humiliation. Many Western Russia observers explain current events as the result of Russia's long suffering at the hands of the West. They believe that Russia is acting out its Weimar syndrome, and that the West is still foolishly refusing to grant Russia a proper place on the world stage. This humiliation theory, if we were to subscribe to it, suggests a number of conclusions that are not immediately obvious, even to many of its proponents. First, it implies that the Russian people carry a special gene that precludes them from living by the rule of law. This is, of course, a racist way of looking at Russians. It is worth remembering that it was the Russian elite who first came forward with this hypocritical dichotomy. They talk of humiliation on the one hand and Western decay on the other. Yet how can a feeble and decaying power humiliate anyone? And why do Western observers readily repeat this Kremlin mantra? Second, Western recognition of the idea that Russia needs spheres of influence to compensate for its humiliations not only runs counter to international legal norms, but is also dismissive of the people whose countries are to become a soothing balm for the Kremlin's wounded ego. Third, if the mythology of humiliation has become the rallying cry for the Russian elite, and indeed its most important reason for retaining power, then how can the West possibly alleviate that humiliation? So far, every Western attempt to satisfy the Kremlin's demands has only prompted it to make new ones. Another myth is related to geopolitics. Many experts in Russia and the West alike assert that Ukraine has become an arena for a geopolitical clash between Russia and the West. This doesn't play as well today in Germany, where geopolitics was once used to justify Hitler's revanchism and prove the inevitability of a clash between geographic spaces and the domination of great powers. Now, geopolitics is used to prove the inevitability of confrontation between Russia and the West, and to blame the West for it. So, if you come across geopolitical terms in discussions of current events, you should know what they really mean. Blurring the borders between war and peace is another way to ensure the survival of the Russian system. Moscow has been able to support the separatists, directly participate in combat, and play the role of a mediator and arbiter in peace talks, all at once. Both the Ukrainians and the West have been forced to reconcile themselves with these roles, so as not to irritate Moscow and provoke even more aggression. Failing to do so would compel Ukraine to face facts and declare a state of war. But Kiev is not prepared to do this. Its military could not withstand a direct clash with the full force of the Russian army. The Ukrainians also fear that declaring a state of war with Russia would hinder its receipt of Western aid. The West, for its part, is even more reluctant than Ukraine to label Russia's behavior as war, since doing so would cast everything back in time to a bipolar world and nuclear standoff. The West is not ready to do this now. But preserving the hybrid nature of this war disorients the world, undermines moral principles, and demoralizes Western and global institutions, forcing them to participate in the Kremlin's pretense. It also creates the possibility that the same process will be played out elsewhere, since the global system has shown that it is not prepared to react to this phenomenon. Quite a few Western observers support the Kremlin's laundry list of demands for Ukraine. Federalization, non-aligned status, and negotiations with the separatists as sovereign political subjects, which would mean returning to the Yalta world order. Recently, these voices have called for dialogue between the European Union and the Eurasian Union, one that would allow Ukraine and other neighboring states to coexist in two spheres of influence, also supported by Moscow. Over time, this would of course be reduced to one sphere of influence, and we all know which sphere this means. Some Western experts have also begun to work out a return to limited sovereignty in one form or another. But do these people really think Russia would honor its agreements? Or that a return to the Yalta system would bring peace to Ukraine? Western experts are doing a disservice not just to the West, but to Moscow as well. First, they are sowing confusion in the West about what is really happening in Russia. They claim that most Russians support Putin and are unlikely to abandon him. In truth, the situation in Russia is getting more complicated, something that isn't captured in Putin's approval ratings. And remember, when the Soviet Communist Party fell, it had 99% approval. There's no reason to think Putin's sky-high numbers are any more meaningful in the present context. Western pundits are also confusing the Kremlin by convincing it that the West will stomach just about anything that it dishes out. Indeed, this false confidence has guided the Kremlin in its suicidal actions. I think the West's sanctions surprised Putin, who had put too much stock in the arguments made by Western accommodators. In this sense, the Western pragmatists share some of the blame for the Ukraine crisis. Concern for the future. Russia's annexation of Crimea and the undeclared war with Ukraine, which could become the benchmark for a new Eurasian and even European history, would hardly have been possible had it not been for nearly 20 years of Western accommodation of Russia. The Western soft line on Russia is one outcome of the loss of direction among Western democracies that has become apparent over the last decade. The West, falling into ideological complacency, appeared to be ready to play a game of let's pretend with the Kremlin. Let's pretend that Russia is on the way to modernizing itself, and that partnership with the Kremlin will help Russia to reform. Let's pretend that Putin is not serious when he calls for containment of the West. The game continued even as the Kremlin shifted to an openly hostile policy to the West from 2004 to 2007. The history of Western civilization has proved that the best environment for progress is one of competition and a clash of ideas. Having lost its former opponent, communism, the West has acquired, without even noticing, a much more dangerous enemy: the corruption and cynicism exported by authoritarian systems. The Russian political and business elite has personally integrated into Western society, and it has succeeded in creating there a powerful money laundering machine and a multi-layered service class that operates that machine. Lawyers, bankers, politicians, journalists, experts, and even entire think tanks. This service class has been lobbying successfully on behalf of the interests of the Russian system in the West. This naturally raises the question: to what extent is the Schroederization of Western foreign policy a result of this lobbying? I can hardly escape the suspicion that part of the Western political establishment understands the nature of the Russian regime and uses it in the furtherance of its own interests. As William Fulbright once said, "The Soviet Union has indeed been our greatest menace, not so much because of what it has done, but because of the excuses it provided us for our failures." This observation could be applied to the West and Russia today. Paradoxically, the West has become a means of survival for the Russian political system. For the first time in recent history, a system that virtually collapsed overnight has managed to limp along by using the winner in the Cold War, and it has done so with some success. Meanwhile, having won the global battle, the Western winner is constantly running to catch up with events, can't predict the future, is unprepared for shocks, and is gradually becoming more intellectually lazy and ideologically muddled, even when confronted with aggression. This is the atmosphere in which authoritarian states find their niche and seek to solve their domestic problems, as Russia is doing in Ukraine, met by feeble responses on the part of the liberal democracies. The war and annexation that have returned to the European scene are troubling signs that liberal civilization has failed to create a system capable of preventing a repetition of 20th century conflicts. Today, with global interconnectedness and the erosion of liberal values, with powerful lobbyists working on behalf of an authoritarian machine within the West, it is harder still to do so. The future of liberal civilization depends on how and when it will rise to the task. Is there a way out of Russia's personalized militarist mode? How sustainable and resilient is Putin's survival paradigm? His choice of a militaristic path shows that he grasps the gravity of the situation and understands that soft authoritarianism is no longer enough. But a turn toward repression and tensions with the West cannot disguise the narrowing of his support base. The recent euphoria over Crimea notwithstanding, most Russians would like his current term in office to be his last. Nor his government's inability to deal with Russia's growing economic and social problems, declining economic growth, crisis of the pension system, shrinking regional budgets, endemic corruption. The harsher system of rule that the Kremlin is trying to build points towards mass repression and even totalitarianism. But there is no ideology or cause to provide a basis for consolidating such a system. Neither the elite nor Russian society at large is ready to blindly follow the leader, and the successful working of any repressive machine that Putin might try to put in place cannot be taken for granted. The state has so far managed to suppress dissent and opposition, but that could change as economic and social ills get worse. A large slice of the political class is used to integration with the West and is unlikely to support intensified isolation or a greater role for the more militarized portion of the elite. Yet the militarists, who currently feel inclined to back Putin, could dismiss him as too soft if grave expressions of discontent start breaking out. The bottom line is that the system of personalized power enjoys better prospects than Vladimir Putin does himself. He does not have to be the one at the helm, and the supporters of the system know it. They may even try to shore up the system by replacing Putin with another figure who could be the new face of a power that is personalized, but which, in the end, turns out to be not all that dependent on this or that particular person. The new number one may be harsher than Putin, or may try to go back to a softer authoritarianism. However, neither soft authoritarianism nor a hybrid regime will be able to keep a restive Russian society under control indefinitely. Russia's treatment of Ukraine will have consequences for developments within Russia. The Kremlin's behavior towards its neighbor has already accelerated domestic changes, by straining Russia's budget, for instance. Putin's tactical victories abroad have boosted his support at home, but that will not last. In order to survive, he will have to find new enemies, new groups of Russophones who need help, and new excuses for aggression, complete with military fervor and a warlike atmosphere. Russia and its people, however, cannot live continually under such conditions. Putin's rule is bound to end in fiasco. Will that spark a change of system, or merely one of personnel? We cannot know. For now, all we can say for sure is that Putinism has stripped Russia of its basic moral principles and inhibitions. But no one can predict what will happen after Putin's fall. In this context, the task of helping Ukraine to become a liberal democracy stands out as work that is of the utmost importance to liberal democratic civilization. The rise of a secure and well-institutionalized democracy in Ukraine will show that a society which has lived through much the same traumatic history of Sovietization as Russia can overcome this difficult legacy and become a law-governed state. Can Ukraine make its choice for Europe and make it stick? It can, but only if the West treats the challenge of helping it as a civilizational necessity and the gravest challenge of the new century so far.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.